So as I mentioned, this talk, the title I gave to this talk is The Dharma of Our Reactions to the Current Ecological Crisis, which is a mouthful just in and of itself. We spent a lot of time in this Sangha over the last months talking about what I mean when I say the ecological crisis. So I'm not going to spend very much time at all, probably no time other than right now, talking about that, the actual crisis itself. It's not, we all know what I mean. So, and that's not what I want to talk about. I want to talk about how we are reacting to this ecological crisis. That's much more a Dharma theme that I can work with. So that's my plan. And I also want to acknowledge that parts of this talk and some of the ideas in this talk came from a wonderful paper by Bhikkhu Bodhi, who put out a paper at the end of June along this theme. And I have, to be honest with you, quite boldly stolen some of his stuff and blended it with other stuff that I have and put it together in a different way. But it was, I was strongly influenced by what Bhikkhu Bodhi had to say in that paper. And I've chosen the word reaction quite carefully, because that's what happens in our, how our minds work, essentially. Basically, if you look at the 12 steps of codependent arising, the key parts of it are something arises at one of our sense doors, something happens, then right after that, a mind process called Vedana arises. Vedana roughly translates as feeling tone. Feeling tone has only three forms: pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And then we react to that Vedana. If it's pleasant, we want more, grasping, greed, wanting. If it's unpleasant, we push it away, aversion, upset, anger, all those various emotions. And if it's neutral, we space out. Delusion arises. So what I want to do is look at these reactions from that the point of view of those things which are often called the three poisons. Greed, anger, hatred, aversion, all varieties of the same thing, and delusion. And how much of our reactions are colored, strongly colored by those reactive forces. And this is just, the other thing I want to say, is I don't want this to be any sort of like a wagging finger talk. This is like, oh, look, I'm a human being, and this is what human beings do. They react. This is most of our life, we're just reacting to things. This is how we operate in the world. Something arises and we react to it, and something else arises and we react to it. This is just, so I don't want in any sense that, for you to think that I'm saying that these reactions are wrong or bad or incorrect or improper or any such thing. They're just human beings. It's what human beings do. But they are problematic, and that's why we want to talk about them. And before I do that, I actually want to read a little bit from the paper. There's a little section of the paper here I want to read. This is something the Buddha said 2,500 years ago when he's talking about something. This is a very interesting, when Bhikkhu Bodhi pointed this out, I went, oh, that's really, This is the Buddha describing something that may happen in the future. This is 2,500 years ago. At that time, one no longer hears in the world the names of ghee, rock honey, dark rock honey, or any sweet delicacies. Rice seeds and rice seedlings turn into grass and weeds. At that time, many thorny bushes grow on this earth, and there are many mosquitoes, gadflies, flies, fleas, snakes, vipers, wasps, centipedes, and poisonous worms. On the surface of the earth, there appear only clay, stones, sand, and gravel. At that time, human beings are capable of being extremely evil, and there is no filial piety towards parents, no respect for teachers and elders, no loyalty, and no righteousness. Those who are rebellious and without principles are esteemed. On seeing one another, human beings are constantly wish to kill one another. They are just like hunters on seeing a herd of deer. Then on this earth, there are many ravines, deep gorges with rushing rivers. The earth is a wasteland. Human beings are scarce. What does this sound like? Sounds like a pretty good description of what's going on in the world right now. This is 2,500 years ago the Buddha wrote this. He then goes on, by the way, later on in the same sutta, to say, then people come to righteousness and this all gets corrected. But it's interesting to me that this description, this idea of what's going on today in the world, the crisis we see in the world, is something that was conceived of a long, long time ago. And if you look in other traditional cultures, you see lots of things like, you know, the great flood in the Bible, you know, where the whole world gets wiped out except for the animals two by two and Noah and his family, right? There's lots of things like this going on in various cultures and various teachings that reflect, in some sense, what's happening right now, which is pretty much like this, pretty destructive, pretty horrible. What's going to happen, or where we're headed, is what this is describing. So, but what about how we're reacting to this. We see this coming. We know it's coming. We see it happening right now. And we go, how are we reacting? In terms of these three poisons I mentioned. How does greed fit into this whole picture? What does greed have to do with this? Greed is another word for climate denial. Think about it. Think about someone who denies the clear evidence of what's going on in the world today, who absolutely denies that it's not happening, la 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 la, you know, whistling past the graveyard perhaps. But that's what's going on there. It's like, here's, I don't believe it because to do so would upset my entire business model. I don't believe it because to do so would mean I would have to give up my job, how I support my family by working in the oil and gas industry. I've got two kids and a mortgage. I can't believe that stuff because if I did, I wouldn't be able to, you know, if you did away with fossil fuels, I wouldn't have a job anymore. Climate denial. That's a natural reaction. You know, I don't believe it because if I did, I'd have to give up my giant gas-guzzling vehicle and my overlarge, overheated house that are so much a part of my identity. Climate denial. It's like climate denial, just like I want to keep things as they are. I want to keep things, all those good things I've got. I want to keep my business. I want to keep the money I'm making doing this business. So I deny that it's happening at all. That's just the reaction of greed. That's greed manifesting. That's all that is. And it's like, we often vilify these people who act in this way, right? We often, oh, what's wrong with these people? How come they not understand, right? That's, I find myself saying that often to myself. This is one of my reactions that I'm talking about. But they're just simply caught in greed. They're simply lost in greed. Perfectly human, natural, emotional reaction. So we have to have a little understanding of them. They're not necessarily just evil people, which is where how they're often personified. They're just lost in greed. So we have to change our perspective a little bit on that. And they're totally, I mean, you know, we think, oh, well, we should just, you know, put out the evidence there and they'll understand. But greed blinds you. Greed colors everything. If you have desire, there's a sutta where the Buddha is talking about desire, and he says desire is like you've got this clear pool of water, and you want to look in the pool of water or the bucket of water, but someone dumps a dye into it, and the dye colors the water, so you don't see clearly anymore. You see this colored reflection that isn't the truth of anything anymore. And that's what greed does to the mind. It colors your understanding. Then there's how I find myself reacting often. I'm familiar with all of these. And that's some form of anger. It's like, how could these people be so, pick your bad words. it's like, and you get riled up. And it's an aversion to that idea of climate denial. How can people be that way? How can people politically support this? And how can people, you know, I don't need to go on, you know what I mean. And we get angry. The problem with anger is it's very difficult to act appropriately in the world from a place of anger. Anger, you know, clouds us, our minds, in a different way than greed, but it still clouds the mind. And we get caught in it. The thing about anger, another thing about anger, is that it feels pretty good sometimes. Like you feel sort of like, you get sort of heated and going, ranting, and it feels sort of powerful, and I'm really saying something really important and makes me important, and you know my rant's going to change the world, and da, da, da. You know, we can very easily go there because it's so seductive in that way. But it doesn't work. Anger just multiplies anger. That's all it ever does. There's a read it. This is the famous the first two verses of the Dhammapada. This is a newer translation, so the wording, if you're familiar with the Dhammapada, the wording might be slightly different than you used to, but it's this is a famous verse talking about exactly this. Phenomena are preceded by the heart, ruled by the heart, made of the heart. If you speak or act with a corrupted heart, then suffering follows you as the wheel of the cart, the track of the ox that pulls it. Phenomena are preceded by the heart, ruled by the heart, made of the heart. If you speak or act with a calm, bright heart, then happiness follows you like a shadow that never leaves. This is like pretty clear instruction. You know, if we're acting out of anger, then we're probably just causing more trouble, causing more suffering in the world, not less. Having said that, I also want to say that anger can be extremely useful as a beginning. You know, we get angry and then we go, oh, we understand that we're angry, and then we sort of mellow that out, but the anger has given us the impetus to actually act. And that's where anger can actually be quite useful. So it's not like anger's bad. Anger's maybe bad if you get stuck there and you just continue to rant for the rest of your life, which people we all know do. We won't mention any names. But that's where some people get stuck in that place of just being angry all the time. And nothing ever, they never accomplish anything. But it is useful as a beginning. So the last of the three poisons I want to talk about is delusion. Delusion is a really interesting thing. First of all, because often we're so deluded, we don't know that we're deluded even. Delusion even hides from us that we're deluded. We can't even see that because of the power of delusion. But how does delusion play into what we're talking about here? This is quite interesting. I've heard people talk in the way I'm going to talk right now many times, including right here in the Sangha. And that's that this feeling we get of resignation. Oh, nothing I can do about that. It's too big. It's too complicated. It's too late already. The world's coming to an end, and the polar bears are going extinct, and which they are, and all these other things. I'm fond of polar bears. So I'm a Canadian. Polar bears are a Canadian thing. And all those things we get so sad, so down, so I give up. It's a pretty normal reaction. But this is a reaction based on delusion. And this is one of the things that I found in this paper that really, wow, what an interesting way to think of things. And the idea is this. Basically, all of those feelings of resignation, sorrow, collapse, I can't handle it, overwhelmed, all arise because we think of ourselves as separate. If we think of ourselves as separate, oh, poor, just little me, how can I affect that big thing? But we're not separate at all. Not at all, at all, at all. We are not separate at all. We're all part of something much larger. We're all directly connected together. And because we're part of this whole, any little thing we do, any tiny little thing we do that works towards solving the problems of the ecological crisis in the world, doesn't matter how small, becomes part of this whole energy of what's called causes and conditions that create change in the world. There's that meme about, a butterfly flaps its wings in China and there's a tornado in Kansas, right? But that's how things are. It's like the Buddha is very talks about this all the time. He's always talking about how things arise based on causes and conditions totally beyond what we understand or think we know or anything. It's like we think everything's just me. The world revolves around me, and if I don't get it, then I get caught in my little world. And we have to sort of step out of my little world into this much larger world, each of us, in our own way, doing these little, tiny gestures, almost, create the causes and conditions to bring about change in the world. I talk about this, if you've ever sat with me, at the end, I always do a dedication of merit where I talk about, may the beneficial energies arising from our practice become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening. That's a very sincere wish. Because the more we practice, the more we create causes and conditions such that things will change, things will change. But as long as we think we're separate, as long as we think there's just little me and this big, huge problem, then it seems like there's no way, how can little me affect it at all? But if I see it, me, this little me as part of this much larger energy field, then it's very powerful. Just shifting our understanding, shifting our how our mind, getting over that delusion that we're separate. There's another form of delusion. Delusion has lots of forms. It's great. Interesting. Another form of delusion is restlessness, of not being able to focus on the issue at hand, of not being able to just, it's like jump, the mind just can't settle, it can't ground. It's like, you know, my mother used to say when I was restless that I had ants in my pants. But it's that sort of mental energy of just sort of jumping around, and, you know, but it's on the mental level, though it often has a physical component. And I see this area of restlessness arising within discussions about the ecological crisis when we come to the topic of what's now called intersectionality, which is the idea that you can't separate the ecological crisis, the ecological problems in the world, from all the other problems in the world. And there are, let's be really honest, many, many problems in the world. I made a list here to remind myself. Ah, yes. The list seems endless, my little note says here. Racism, sexism, misogyny, gun violence, poverty, religious intolerance, LGBTQ issues. I mean, the list is endless. I mean, I'm sure you could add more things to my list. Those are the ones that came off the top of my head. And it is absolutely true, I want to be very clear, it's absolutely true that there are intersections between all of these issues and the issues of the ecological crisis. For instance, people of color and people who live in poverty suffer way more whenever there's an environmental disaster. I was just listening to NPR today as I was driving to work, and there was an article about the people who lived in the trailer parks around here during the flood 5 years ago, who lost their homes, and because they didn't own the land, and the person who owned the land decided, I'm going to make this something else now, I'm not going to have a trailer park here anymore, they just lost their home. Gone. Because they were poor. If you think about Hurricane Katrina, when Hurricane Katrina struck, who suffered the most? The people who lived in the lowest part of the city, the part of the city that was way below the level of the levees. Well, guess what? This is all people of color and poor people. They all lost their homes. A lot of them still have never got anything back. It's true. I mean, we can't deny this. We can't for one second deny that these intersections exist. And I don't want to try to. In fact, I think it's important that we're aware, that we try and constantly be aware of these intersections. The danger, however, this is where restlessness arises, I think, is that we somehow get the idea that I have to solve all of these problems at once. I can't just focus on what seems to me, at least, to be the most important one right now, which is the climate crisis, because, well, if we don't solve that one, 20 years is not going to be anything to solve anymore, right? 30 years, 50 years, who knows? But it's going to get a lot worse. And this is a problem that we know human beings created, and with something we can actually solve. Whether, I don't know, I mean, people are going to yell at me for this, but maybe, but I don't know if we can ever solve racism, for instance. It's like people hate, always have, always will. I don't think that's something you can solve. It's something you can be aware of. You can do whatever you can to change things that change legally, change things in lots of different ways. But it's been around since there were five people in the world. And then another five people over here in a different cave, and they were fighting. It's just, it's important that we pay attention to it. But I think, for me, we have to be very careful not to just get caught up in this sort of utopian idea that if we can solve all the problems of the world all at once, including, of course, climate change and all these other things, we can somehow come up with some answer that just solves everything. And in the end, because we end up thinking about it and thinking about it and thinking about it and philosophizing about it, we do nothing. That's the danger of intersectionality. Very important that we stay aware, I think, very important that we stay aware of how different communities are affected in different ways and in ways that we can't even understand. But we can't lose sight of the goal by trying to solve everything at once. It's a difficult balance. So what's the solution? Here we have all these different reactive mind states that make it difficult or stop us from acting at all. So what do we do? What's the solution to this issue? What a surprise. The first thing that's most important in dealing with all of these mind states, all of these reactive mind states, is mindfulness. Just if we can actually be aware, if we can actually see, oh, look, that's arisen in my mind. This pattern of reaction is there. Then we have a chance of getting past them. So mindfulness is the key to the whole thing. If we can be mindful of our reactions, then we might still be reacting. We might still be ranting internally or denying internally or whatever we're doing, getting caught in utopian fantasies or who knows. But that the awareness that mindfulness gives us allows us to sort of step back from those reactive mind states and gives us a chance to sort of see things more clearly. I mean, mindfulness, you know, the popular name for mindfulness these days is insight meditation. We can actually have insights into what's going on in the world in a very clear way if we step back from the reactive process. And the way we step back from the reactive process is just to see that that's what's actually happening right now. Here I am again ranting about this stuff. Or here I am again, whatever it is your favorite way of dealing with these things are. Here I am caught again in this feeling of helplessness. So that's the first step. The second step, and this is probably even much harder, is to see those unwholesome mind states arising and be able to say, and that's okay. It's my favorite mantra these days, and that's okay. I'm just a human being, and this is what happens because I'm human. I have a human emotions, and I get caught in these stories. And I'm not saying that we have to say, it's okay that, you know, the world's going to hell in a handbasket, as my dad used to say. That's not okay, but it's okay that I'm reacting in the way I'm reacting. I'm just a human being, and I'm reacting. But I don't. Otherwise, then what happens is I see these reactions. I'm mindful. I see the reactions, and then what do I do? Now I start beating myself up. oh, there's stupid Barry caught in a rant again. You know, that's where we go. We go into just another layer of reaction. We get into self-blame and lack of self-worth, and I'm no good, and how can I possibly do anything? I'm always caught in this helpless feeling, and blah, 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 blah. So we have to be able to acknowledge that we're human beings, and we have, we'll call it the dark side for lack of a better term. We have unwholesome emotions sometimes. We get caught. We're not perfect. At least I'm not perfect, for sure. But I figure it's most of us aren't perfect. It's that being able to say, and that's okay. Because once we can say that, once we can acknowledge our shortcomings and acknowledge our emotional reactions, and just be okay with, well, yeah, that's what's going on, but that's okay. Then I can reach a place of equanimity. Equanimity, if you look at the list the Buddha makes, Buddha, all those famous lists, equanimity is often at the top of the list of many important progressions of practice. Equanimity is like that mind state that says, I'm totally aware of what's going on, and my heart is wide open. Even though it's as horrible as it is, I can go there and be okay. This is, the Pali word is upekkha, and the Sanskrit is upeksham. There are two variations of the same thing because those are both Indo-European roots. And normally that word, the word is always translated as equanimity. The tricky part with equanimity, there's always a problem. There's a solution and a problem, right? The problem with equanimity is if you're not careful, you drift into indifference. Indifference is called the near enemy of equanimity. It looks like equanimity. I'm very calm, I'm very cool, everything's fine. But indifference is like totally disconnected. It's like, I don't care. Who cares that the world's going to a hell in a handbasket, you know? I'm going to go get an ice cream. So we have to watch for that. But if we can actually be in a place of equanimity, then we have this steady space to react clearly to what's actually happening and actually start to do something. Actually take wholesome action that's from this balanced state of mind. There are people who will say to you that what I'm talking about is selfish. That, you know, you're just trying to sort of be this sort of quiet, holy person who's always calm. You're retreating from the world. And I want to read something the Buddha said about exactly that. Because we need, what I'm saying is we need to find that equanimity to allow us to act skillfully. This is a famous teaching called the Two Acrobats. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Sumbas, where there was a town. There, the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, once in the past, an acrobat set up his bamboo pole and addressed his apprentice thus, 'Come, climb the bamboo pole and stand on my shoulders.' Having replied, 'Yes, teacher,' the apprentice climbed up on the bamboo pole and stood on the teacher's shoulders. Then the acrobat said to the apprentice, 'You protect me, and I'll protect you. Thus guarded by one another, protected by one another, we'll display our skills, collect our fee, and get down safely from the bamboo pole.' 'That's not the way to do it, teacher.' 'You protect yourself, teacher, and I'll protect myself. Thus, each self-guarded and protected will display our skills, collect our fee, and get down safely from the bamboo pole. That's the method there, the Blessed One said. It's just as the apprentice said, I will protect myself, bhikkhus, thus should the establishment of mindfulness be practiced. I will protect others, bhikkhus, thus should the establishment of mindfulness be practiced. So, once you protect yourself, then you can protect others. Once you protect yourself, you can find balance. These are acrobats. This is all about balance of mind. This is a metaphor. Once you have balance of mind yourself, then you can help others find balance as well. It's a beautiful image. You know, just, it's like, we think, I got to take care of everybody else first. I got to go and solve all these problems. And what the Buddha is saying, no, I'm sorry. You got to find your own balance first. Then you're ready to go out and actually help solve the problems in the world. You have to take care of yourself first. Find your own balance. Find equanimity. Then you can act skillfully in the world. It's a different way of looking at things. There's another aspect of this I want to talk about. We're always encountering suffering these days. And all you can do is pick up a newspaper, turn on a radio, turn on a TV, go around town, for that matter, and you'll encounter suffering. It's what's happening. We see it more all the time. And this could be the suffering of people affected by climate change, like the people in the Bahamas, where the whole town just was totally destroyed. Amazes me. The suffering of animals. I'm talking about polar bears. Right? But polar bears are actually going extinct because the pack ice that they use to hunt seals is melting. There's no pack ice, hardly any pack ice left in the Arctic Ocean, and there's no place for polar bears to hunt anymore. They're going to actually disappear. They're going to go extinct. It's horrible. And, I mean, you can even say, you know, as I've heard people say, you know, we see the suffering of the earth itself. Mother Earth is suffering. And some of people think in those terms and feel in those terms as well. And we feel empathy for those beings that are suffering, whether it's human beings or animals or insects or whatever. We feel empathy for them. It's a natural result of encountering suffering. But empathy isn't enough. If you're mindful, if you have equanimity and empathy arises, then what follows is compassion. And compassion is empathy overlaid with a desire to act, actually do something about it. Compassion is a call to action. And compassion can arise if our mind is clear and still. If we have equanimity, then compassion can really have its powerful effect and lead us to actually acting wholesomely and correctly and actively in the world. Actually doing something. I want to read something from Sharon Salzberg here. This is going back to my theme about it doesn't have to be some giant thing. A compassionate act does not have to be grandiose. The very simple action of love, of opening to people, of offering somebody some food, of saying hello, of asking what happened, of really being present, all are very powerful expressions of compassion. Compassion enjoins us to respond to pain, and wisdom guides the skillfulness of that response, telling us when and how to respond. Through compassion, our lives become an expression of all that we understand and care about and value. And compassion arises when we have that open heart and clear mind. Compassion is tricky, however. Like, I mean, there's always yes, but. Here's my yes, but for compassion. Without the balance of mind, without the balance of mind that and mindfulness and equanimity, compassion very easily shifts into one of two what are called, compassion so big it has two near enemies. Interesting. We either fall into being overwhelmed or we fall into pity. When we're overwhelmed, we lose touch with our own pain, let alone the pain of everything around us. We withdraw. We retreat. When we feel pity, which may externally sort of look like compassion, then we once again, we withdraw, but now we're sort of looking down at those poor people who are suffering so much. You know, it's sort of we're looking down our noses at those people in a way. I'm up here and they're down there. Now I'm not connected anymore. Pity separates you from what the suffering you've encountered. It's not compassion at all. In fact, it pretends to be compassion. Might even feel good, but it isn't compassion at all. So we have to watch when compassion arises that we don't shift into either being totally over, oh my God, there's that, and then there's this, and then there's that. And that's where that equanimity is so important, because we can keep our balance despite all the things that we start seeing. That's the key part of why equanimity is so important. Compassion arises, but we're okay. We have that balance. I'm not saying we can ignore what's going on. We shouldn't ignore what's going on, but we're not like just so blown away that we just collapse. It allows us to see. So now one last question I had here is, how do we actually start to do something? Where do we start? How do we actually, all right, now I'm going to actually do something. It starts with right understanding, the first step on the Eightfold Path. We have to understand that the world is in crisis, number one. And we have to understand that we're called to do something about it. That we feel this really strong need to act, not just to think about it. And at the same time, we have the right understanding to know that if we're not careful, we'll fall into one of these mind states I've been talking about, one of these reactive mind states. We understand that as well, that there's some carefulness we have to have in how we operate in the world around these issues. Because it's very easy to just fall into reactive mind states. And then, from that right understanding, driven by compassion, right intention, the second step on that Eightfold Path, how convenient, will arise. It'll become clear. It's not like we have to think about it too much. We don't have to make grandiose plans and schemes. Right intention will naturally arise from right understanding and compassion. and we'll act. We'll actually do something as opposed to just react to what's actually happening. We're actually shifting from this reactive mind, these reactive mind states, to actually acting in the world skillfully. Based very directly on the Buddhist teachings. Nothing I said here isn't directly out of the Dhamma. And I want to repeat, it doesn't matter how insignificant what you're doing seems. Don't get caught in that one. Of like, oh, this is so small, it's not going to make any difference. Every little bit, every little thing we do, everything. I'm these days I'm working up in this lodge and I'm re-glazing windows so they don't leak so much, so the building won't lose so much energy. This is actually Dharma in action as far as I'm concerned. This is like saving energy. This is something I can do to actually change the world. Simple little job, just reglazing windows. But you start to think like that, and it's like, oh, gee, I never thought about that. You know, I just turn my thermostat down a little bit in the house, or you know, it doesn't have to be a big deal. If we make a big deal out of it, then we think, oh my God, I'll never do that. Just little things. All we have to do. Everybody does a bunch of little things, it turns into a big thing. You all know me well enough, I have to finish with a poem. So, this is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In. It's called Remember This. Vast and changeless, the ground of being is not rocked by ripples on the pond. The firmament from which we spring, the divinity at the heart of things, doesn't wax or wane with mind states or wither in the wind. We come from stronger stuff than feelings. Essence does not fail or fade, diminish or trade reality for illusion. We are wordless, wide, and wise beyond time. Within us is a flame of truth that never dies. Let that be the focal point of life. Let that be the light that guides us from the shadows.